Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. On this week's episode...
Funny how many people get these things wrong. I go into a lot of jazz clubs and I go, what made you build it like this?
Simon Cook, Managing Director of London Jazz Club Ronnie Scott's, knows a thing or two about hitting the right note when it comes to interiors that play a fitting second fiddle to the music. Put up your feet and click your fingers if you must as we head backstage at 47 Frith Street. Plus, a bar and hospitality consultant gives his read on entertaining spaces and reviving an architectural gem in London's Bloomsbury.
It's a complete transportation. It's very glamorous. There's a beautiful tented ceiling, very sumptuous finishes and a gorgeous big glitter ball hanging from the ceiling.
Plus, our design headlines of the week. All that coming up here on Section D. Over a nearly 60-year history, Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club has established itself as one of Europe's finest venues for the genre. The music may not be to everyone's taste, but jazz clubs can be counted on to be predictable in appearance and atmosphere, and that's not a bad thing. So what's behind the timeless design of these clubs? Here, Monocle's Daphne Karnizis takes us for a walk.
There's always a new kid on the block in Soho, adding to the huge diversity of restaurants, cafes, pubs, bars and clubs in what's one of London's most popular entertainment neighbourhoods. One day you're having a drink at a cocktail bar, the next it's been shut down to make way for the latest trendy burger joint. But there are some buildings whose signage and design have stood the test of time. One of those is Frith Street number 47, which for over 50 years has been the home of a real London institution, Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club. Jazz is undoubtedly a continually evolving form of music, from Dixieland to swing, bebop and ragtime to freeform and jazz rock fusion, but the design of the archetypal jazz club stands largely unchanged. Ronnie Scott's is perhaps as classic a jazz club as you'll find in appearance, style and atmosphere. Let's take a walk inside.
I'm Simon Cook, and I am the Managing Director of Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club.
The club's been around for 58, 59 years, so virtually everybody who you've heard of in jazz has played here.
Nina Simone, Ella Fitzgerald, Miles Davis, Charles Mingus, and...
A very young, swinging, roaring big band, Buddy Rich and his orchestra.
Drums keep pounding a rhythm to the brain. La-di-da-di-dee. La-di-da-di-da.
It's a small club, holds 220, but the amount of support, I mean, I've got about 40 staff working every night to make this work. We have a very strong black, gold and red theme going on, if you like. In a broad way, the bar's got a slightly glittery gold look about it with the lights on. Could do with a redesign our bar, to be frank. Anybody out there wants to come and redesign our bar? We've sort of got a bit of a theme going on of the red velvet and the dark black colours. Yeah, we have a look that Jack Garcia came up with, which I think has really stood the test of time. It's a classic look for a jazz club. We've no desire to change it. Jack Garcia did a tremendous job on it. I've always said the job that Sally Green, who was the owner at the time, still is, and employing Jack to come and do it, he did a very expensive job, but it's really worked. I think he's made the place look fantastic. What's unique, in a way, about Ronnie's is that we have bench seating, as you might call it, on both sides of the room, obviously pointing into the middle, where customers sit in a row on red velvet banquettes, you might say. And the banquettes have got tables in front of them where you can put your drink or your food, should you be eating or drinking. And they've also got small table lamps on them all around the club. That accommodates people on both sides, so it kind of mirrors it. There's a uniformity to the room. And then directly in front of the stage, there's tables and chairs on a slightly lower level that we call the pit, rather charmingly. And then we are at this moment stood just behind the pit, in front of the bar, which is at the back of the room, and in front of the sound desk, which is in a small box just over our right shoulder.
Go back to the ancient Greeks. They kind of built amphitheatres. I mean, it's fairly straightforward. You know, there's the stage and here's the audience, right? And that's how they built these arenas, and they're fantastic looking arenas. And that's what we've got here. We have height. We have height at the back. We have height on the sides. And therefore, it acts as a kind of live arena. That's how these rooms work best. And then you come across some jazz clubs who could have done that and just didn't. A classic example of somewhere where they could have done a really good job. And I mean, it's a nice joint. And it's got, you know, sort of show-stopping backdrop to the stage. But Dizzy's in New York, in the Lincoln Center, is all on one level. And it kind of, because it's got this picture window behind the stage looking at lights of New York and Central Park, I think they feel that that's enough. Great. Yeah, I think they do. And indeed, it is a great view and their lighting is really good on stage and their sound is good. But why didn't you build up the back? I don't get it. Plenty of space, plenty of height, didn't do it. So the gig isn't quite, you know, what I'd have done with it personally. Funny how many people get these things wrong. I go into a lot of jazz clubs and I go, what made you build it like this? We have a lot of equipment here. Some venues, say you're a promoter or you're, say, I don't know, Bon Jovi for want of a name, and you go in and play Wembley, you take all your kit in with you. Loudspeakers, sound desks, the whole lot comes off trucks. Jazz clubs have most of it already. Bands don't travel in vans with huge crews because it's a lower budget operation. So you have all this equipment. So we have a piano, we have bass amps, we have at least 3 drum kits, we have at least 2 full sets of percussion. We were talking about how much stuff actually hangs out the ceiling. This is the weird thing. And most customers can't see it because it's dark when they come in. And the lights are all and the attention is all at the stage and so on. But there's an awful lot of stuff hangs out the ceiling in a building like this. Because not only have we got the 5 lighting bars and we've got 3 camera positions for when we film or stream. You've also got the aircon blowing down. You've got infill speakers, you've got the main speakers, you've got CCTV, you've got all sorts of stuff. But we also have ambient lighting to make the room look good, which is things you can see. And this was all part of Jacques Garcia's big story. There's about 35 or 40 of the big lampshades, and they, 12 years ago, they cost £680 each. And there's about 35, 40 of them hanging out the ceiling just in this room.
The club's walls are covered with black and white framed portraits of the jazz legends that have played here.
There's a classic jazz photograph look, which is the black and white photo in a white mount with a black frame. And you'll find this in virtually every jazz club in the world. We like to think we started it, but who knows? It's an interesting story that the look of the club, the black and white photo thing, is what people expect. But sometimes we kind of want to get away from it. We haven't quite plucked up the courage to do it. We feel it is intrinsically part of this, the main Ronnie Scott's club.
With the introduction of the night tube, London's fast becoming a 24-hour city. But Soho's slow but sure gentrification means its reputation as a hub for live gigs has somewhat collapsed, with under 10 music venues remaining from a peak of 17 as the music scene regroups away from the city centre. Smaller music spots like Ronnie Scott's create an intimacy between artists and their fans, perhaps unlike any other entertainment venue, and that's largely down to its design.
Someone was saying to me the other day, all busy bars, oh, they redesign themselves every 6 years, but this will look like this in 10 years' time. The look endures.
Monocle's Daphne Carnese is there, speaking to Simon Cook, the managing director of Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club. Our special thanks to Daphne.
I'm hip, I'm no square, I'm alert, I'm awake, I'm aware.
That was Blossom Dearie performing at Ronnie Scott's way back in 1966. The jazz musician never cared for what was trendy, a quality which surely helped give her music its timeless allure. The same could be said about a well-designed club. And even if some of history's best night spots are no longer with us, their influence lingers on. That's not to say all the influences were entirely positive, and in some instances the design of such clubs was used to enforce racial segregation. The Cotton Club, later a regular haunt of Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong, became one of the most popular venues in the Big Apple during the Prohibition era. Opened in Harlem in 1923, the club's black staff tended to white clientele until society finally caught up and deemed the revelry in poor taste. The club shuttered in the 1940s.
Well?
I want to be alone.
Where have you been? I suppose I can cancel the Vienna contract?
I just want to be alone.
You're going to be very much alone, my dear madame. This is the end.
Sweden's most celebrated screen star Greta Garbo was once employed at Stockholm's former PUB department store, now home to the city's Grand Haymarket Hotel, and a very pink tribute to the actress in the form of a ground floor cafe. Local design firm Concept blended elements of the original shop with visual cues taken from Garbo's career on the silver screen. Sherbet pink meets polished gold textures, geometric patterns, and lush greenery to boot.
The Ambassador Hotel was quite large. It had a lot of rooms, and the Coconut Grove was its primary nightclub, dining area, so forth.
Ed Dover once worked as a technician at the Coconut Grove, a legendary nightclub housed in one of the most impressive hotels Los Angeles has ever seen. The Ambassador.
When you walked in the lobby of the hotel, of course, it was just a regular lobby, but very, very fancy. The entrance to the Coconut Grove went down several steps to the dining area. And then on either side of the dining area were sort of box seat areas for those who wanted a little more privacy. And my sound booth was at the end of one of those box seat areas.
For decades, just about every star of the silver screen worth mentioning passed under the tall indoor palm fronds of the Coconut Grove. And while the Ambassador Hotel no longer stands, its pastel-hued tropical design influence still represents a high watermark of Californian design. Why is it that some bars and restaurants stand the test of time, while others go down as fads? What design touchstones give a venue its hum or a dining room its delight? Well, Robbie Barr is the founder and director of Gorgeous Group, a London-based consultancy that works with designers to fine-tune storytelling and the hospitality experience as a whole. I began by asking Robbie about his work and upcoming projects, and started by questioning whether lazy design means that restaurants and bars are all starting to look a little samey.
I think bars and restaurants are going through a change where it has been about sort of, you know, coming up with the next big thing and the next best thing, and that whole minimalist sort of clean cut look has been very popular. But actually, when it comes to what I do, coming up with a big idea of what that bar or that restaurant's going to be famous for, you start there and think about the audience, and then you start looking at the design. You do find the same old thing, and you could, you know, you wake up sometimes in a hotel room or go to the same restaurant or go to a breakfast room, and they can feel the same. But actually, you know, the best places to go to are the ones with their own spirit, and they've got their own audience, and they've been thought about and considered. So actually, restaurants and bars should be about escapism. So if you can come up with a story which allows you to be someone else or go somewhere else, that's a wonderful thing.
I completely agree. Could you maybe give us one or two tangible examples of objects that you in your work have come across that have been able to tell stories? And I don't know whether that's an open fireplace that, you know, puts you in mind of a country house that you then build a restaurant around, or, you know, I don't know whether it's a particular type of service that makes you feel like you're being luxuriously waited upon. Do you have any objects you could bring to mind that tell kind of stories or the basis for kind of bringing these stories out of restaurants?
Yeah, I think when you're looking at, you know, like a grill or a kitchen, I'm working on a project at the moment in the Black Forest in Germany, where we have, you know, brought to life a beautiful live whole singing and dancing fire grill, in live grill which brings to life this sort of, you know, the Black Forest story and the ingredients and the produce and the seasons, and the grill is a big feature. And when you walk into the restaurant, you'll think, wow, what is this? And you'll look outside the windows and you'll see the forest, Black Forest, and a beautiful stream and in front of you, and instantly there is a connection. And so I think that's quite powerful. Equally, when you're working on, you know, we just opened a project in Rio at the Copacabana Palace by the ocean, you're by the sea, and it's very hedonistic. And I think when you're looking at projects by the ocean, you need to come up with a story which is really in keeping with the spirit of the city or the place you're in. And if you're in, you know, if you're in Rio and you're on the Copacabana beach, then you want to bring an element of that into what you're creating. So the bar by the pool has to be an element of, you know, hedonistic sort of voyeur, you know, sort of losing yourself and forgetting about all your worries and just indulging in something which is, you know, once in a lifetime even. It's magical. It's very unique. You know, if you've got those different hooks, then you've got a great story to start with, and you can start layering the story, and that, you know, the design is part of that, the interior design, but it's all those other things like the tools and the props. And it's a bit like a production, you know, like a Wes Anderson show, a film. You know, you don't just rely on one thing. You have to bring all those different elements of the story together, all those jigsaw pieces, and put them together and make them feel like an amazing production. I remember when Alan Yao created Hakkasan, and you know, I worked with him on Hakkasan. I remember, you know, you walk down those steps at Han Wei Place and you could be in Shanghai in the 50s. It's transporting you somewhere else. And it's the smell, it's the light, it's the music, it's the vibe, it's that little bit of magic dust, which, you know, is really important when you're trying to transport people to a different place.
And it's this wonderful stagecraft that's informed the Gorgeous Group, the company of which you're the head and founder, all of your beautiful projects that you've undertaken. I'm going to ask you a slightly delicate question now. You're a consultant and you work with people who are putting lots of money in. They pay you for your services, clearly, but are you allowed to push back a little bit and, you know, help people hone their vision, but maybe take them away from certain ideas as well? Because I think, you know, not every story is suitable for every consumer. Do you have to push back
completely
a little?
Completely. Every day. People come to us for the big idea, and we are an agency which creates ideas, and those ideas get translated into reality, whether it's a perfect bar or a perfect restaurant. And you have to, you know, I spend a lot of time helping people understand what they're trying to do, what they're trying to achieve. And there's a lot of change management, and there's a lot of that sort of, you can ask someone to go and look at a restaurant or a bar, a client, and they might go into that restaurant or bar, but they might not see what you see. So you seriously have to, you know, work at it. We can compromise to a certain degree, but, you know, we have to start out thinking, well, this is the big ambition, this is the story. And we can start pulling back down the line, but we've got to start on the same page.
And I'd like to ask you about another forthcoming project about which there is much excitement. It's a beautiful old kind of biscuit and cream coloured terracotta clad pile right here in London. Yeah. It's formerly the Russell Hotel. It's going to be the Principal. I think there's lots of exciting designers working on it. I think Tara Bernard is doing some of the suites. You know, the date at which it opens has been pushed back a little bit, but you can tell us a little bit about the programming. And I suppose I'm interested as well in how you shoulder the responsibility of an architectural icon, but also breathing new life into it and turning it into a place that people once again will flock to and will see for its beauty and will want to hang out in. So tell us about the Principal.
The Principal London is an incredible project, and, you know, it's a beautiful building, as you say, sort of cafe au lait, as they say. And Fitzroy Dolls was this, you know, amazing guy, the sort of Terence Conran of his day, I guess. And he was a brilliant visionary. And this beautiful building, this facade, is this wonderful storytelling, you know, on the facade. But when you get into the building, it's like a wondrous playground. And then the bar, which is pretty much my domain, Fitz's, you know, it's a mix and match of styles and sort of, you know, it's a complete transportation. It's very glamorous. There's a beautiful tented ceiling, very sumptuous finishes, and a gorgeous big glitter ball hanging from the ceiling, and a little bit of music and unexpected showtime and extremely wonderful drinks, which are inspired from yesteryear and different eras. And whilst Fitzroy Dolls was the architect, sort of, you know, who created this beautiful building, we've just given it, breathed new life into this building. And And we've created different stories. But when you're creating these spaces, you've got to create almost blank canvases and for people to enjoy. It's all about the people. It's all about the guests. They've got to walk into these spaces and make them their own.
Robbie Barr there, founder and director of hospitality consultancy The Gorgeous Group, right here in London. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined on the line now by Monocle, friend of the show, of course, contributor, yes, design journalist and curator by night, James Taylor Foster. James, you've scanned the headlines for a few eagle-eyed picks of what's going on in the world of architecture, and I believe you're taking us first to Venice.
Absolutely. Venice is always the centre of everything when we talk about architecture, but it's been quite an intense beginning to March. There's been the main press conference of the Venice Architecture Biennale, in which its curators, Yvonne Farrell and Shelley McNamara, two Dublin-based practitioners who were wild cards in many ways when they were announced last year, have started to expand a little bit on what they're planning to do. The Biennale in Venice, for those who don't know, is sort of split between three components. You have this big building called the Arsenale, which is where the Venetian shipmakers used to make rope. It's long, it's industrial, it has this kind of romantic charm about it. Then you have the central pavilion, which is more of a white box. And then you have the national pavilions. And the curators have started to expand on the idea behind the central exhibition and the exhibition of the Arsenale, which they've called Free Space. Free Space being a study of what architecture and the built environment is when it's generous. What architects can do to enhance the built environment, to enhance indirectly and in many ways directly people's lives by working up small gestures in their day-to-day operation. Buildings don't have to be, they argue, terrifying edifices which we just need to ignore. They can be conducive to the way we live. What's interesting about what they revealed is, for the first time, I think one of the main problems with the curators, as they're called, the artistic directors of the Biennale, who are always famous architects, or have been certainly in recent years, is that, you know, an architect is not necessarily a curator. Like, a curator is certainly not an architect. And they have been very open in saying that they are approaching this exhibition as architects. They are looking at the exhibition sites as buildings. They want to reveal the qualities that these buildings have and what they describe as the heroic dimension of these spaces. This is super interesting because the Venice Biennale has always been slightly conflicted in how it presents stuff. You know, presenting architecture is always difficult because you can never actually build the building. So you rely on photographs and images and models. But I think this is going to be an incredibly spatial experience. I think it's going to be actually quite awesome. And I think this will actually signal a new direction for the Biennale.
And James, if I ask you to slip off your hat as a design journalist and slip on your hat as a curator, I believe there's some corporate shilling at work here. I believe you're actually taking part at the Venice Architecture Biennale. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how you've responded to this brief, this slightly different brief this year?
Yeah, it's a really good question. ArcDes, for which I'm curator, the Swedish Centre for Architecture and Design, was invited to take part in the central exhibition. Although it's all confidential, Josh, I can't possibly divulge what we're actually doing here for the threat of the Biennale. Your question is very, very interesting because it's a complex situation. You have curators of a show, then curators of a show curating curators of a room, who are then curating collaborators. It's a diplomatic challenge. It's also a challenge in the sense of, with the Venice Biennale, unlike most exhibitions of architecture in the world, is that you are basically creating a shared exhibition, a collaborative exhibition with people that you don't know and you don't know what they're doing. And you have to it's all about these connections of trust between the different levels of curators. It's in some ways been quite easy for us to respond to this manifesto of Free Space because it's extremely timely, but also timeless. It sort of has kind of enduring quality about it. And I think that as we sort of move into, I think, a more reflective period in architectural discourse and dialogue, in which people are not so afraid of accepting that something can be good without being radically innovative, this Biennale comes at a moment in which a new movement can sort of be galvanized on a global scale.
And I do enjoy hearing you talk about it, James. And the Venice Architecture Biennale will obviously be highly covered by Section D and by Monocle 24. Your final story, James, it's a little less highfalutin than the others. Tell me about the set at the Oscars.
Did you see the Oscars, Josh?
I didn't. It's past my bedtime, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, I had to stay up late, but it was incredible. There was this set designed by Derek McLean, who's this sort of Tony and Emmy winning award scenic designer, who's essentially, he's done many of these before, but of course, this was the 90th anniversary of the Oscars. So to sort of demonstrate the significance of the event, 45 million Swarovski crystals were integrated into this enormous proscenium arch. And it was interesting because the architectural community sort of latched onto it and started to apply rather interesting terminology to what it was described by the architect's newspaper in New York as a maximalist design, a maximalist fantasy, in fact. And, you know, it was shimmering. It was this amazing combination of real-world sort of scenic design, three-dimensional scenic design with digital interventions, crystal, metal, mirror. It was bizarrely mesmerizing, Josh.
Our very special thanks to Seer Sage and friend of the show, James Taylor Foster, who is also a curator at the Swedish Centre for Architecture and Design in Stockholm. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. The Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch by emailing our producer, Daphne Karnesis. She's at dk@monocle.com. Next week, what are pavilions for and why on earth can't we get enough of them? We're off to Mexico to meet the young architect Frida Escobedo, who's been appointed designer of this year's Serpentine Pavilion, the prestigious annual commission from the Serpentine Galleries, right here in London. Section D was produced by Ben Ryland and Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fenner and we're leaving you with Nina Simone, who crept the dusty boards of Frith Street at Ronnie Scott's. Here's Cineman.
Oh, Cineman, where you gonna run to? Cineman, where you gonna run to? Where you gonna run to? All on that day, will I run to the rock? Please hide me around the rock. Please hide me around the rock. Please hide me, Lord, all on the day. But the rock cried out, I can't hide you, the rock cried out. I can't hide you, the rock cried out. I ain't gonna hide you, God, all on the day. I said, rock, what's the matter with you, rock? Don't you see I need you, rock? Lord, 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 all on that day. So I ran to the